From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Like Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn how comics are being used in medical education and healthcare. Then we'll meet the founder and director of the Latino Arts String Program at the United Community Center.
As immigrants or children of immigrants, our cultures are either misunderstood or poorly portrayed or absolutely not talked about. And so, to me, a good way to do that was through music.
Plus, we'll tell you how to infuse Native American culture into your next trip in Wisconsin.
I think it's important for people when they're thinking about their travel plans to, you know, maybe think about dropping in one of the tribal communities over the winter, checking out the tribe's communities, and discovering Native Wisconsin.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Graphic medicine refers to the intersection between comics and the discourses of medicine. It's a relatively new, broad field, and the topics range from materials for doctors, healthcare professionals, patient experiences, climate change, and much more. Dr. Michael Green is a professor of humanities and medicine at the Penn State College of Medicine, and also a pioneer in graphic medicine. He'll be this year's Medical College of Wisconsin annual humanities speaker, and ahead of that, he joins me to share how he uses comics in medical education. Dr. Green begins by explaining the early material of what is now known as graphic medicine.
The kind of stories that we're referring to usually were illness memoirs. People either who had personal experience with illness or maybe family members of people who had illness, and they wanted a way to express themselves. And look, the medium of comics has been around for forever. I mean, it's, you know, cavemen arguably created the first comics, but it sort of took off in the 1930s. And the idea of there being some medically relevant comics is not brand new. In World War II, for example, the Public Health Service and the Army produced a variety of educational comics for soldiers that were focused on, you know, preventing illness. A lot of times, how to not get venereal diseases, or what to do, you know, how to avoid getting malaria, things like that. So public health comics have been around for a long time. But the idea of these illness memoirs took off much more recently, in the past 20 years, probably.
As you mentioned, using visual aid to help people learn is nothing new, but what research has been done on the effectiveness of including visuals in healthcare or teaching, especially when it comes to graphic medicine? What are you finding?
Well, so as an academic discipline, it is fairly new, but there is a growing body of research. I should say that there's different purposes that these comics are made. So sometimes there's, you know, an explicit goal of using it to increase somebody's knowledge about a topic. So, you know, how can we use comics to teach about X? But that's not the only goal. Sometimes the goal is focused on understanding a patient's experience with illness. And it's not necessarily giving them knowledge or changing their behavior. It's just saying, hey, I had this experience and I want to share what that was like. And that's very useful. I mean, especially for medical personnel to understand a patient's point of view about an illness is, while it's not radical, it's different than what we do typically in medical school, which is focus on the clinical aspects and, you know, the physiology and pathophysiology. But getting inside the head of a patient and saying, you know, what's it like to have this disorder? That's important and a little bit different than how we typically approach it. And the reason I teach it is because I believe that, you know, using comics, both reading comics and making comics, can actually help students develop skills that are important for becoming a better doctor. There are some overlapping skills of reading a comic and making a comic and being a diagnostician and a clinician.
You mentioned your course is for fourth-year medical students. So why do you think that's an especially important teaching tool at this stage in a medical student's career? What skills are you developing? Can you share some examples of the work you have your students do?
Sure. And I've been teaching fourth year students since 2009. And so the reason I find it so valuable during the fourth year is because they actually have a lot of clinical experience at that time. A first year med student, what they know about medicine generally is, you know, from their experience being maybe a patient or just a person, and what they read in books. But they haven't interacted with patients very much, and it's all kind of theoretical kind of issues. By the time they're a fourth year med student, they've had experience, you know, not a lot of experience, but experience in internal medicine and pediatrics and OBGYN and surgery and, you know, and other specialties. And they've been around the block and they've had some positive experiences. They've had some negative experiences, and they're just much more mature in their development as physicians, that they have something to say, and they have some experience from which they could comment on, you know, when they're reading the books. And so I find it really useful during that particular time. And the students appreciate it as well, because one of the things that I really try to focus on in the course that I teach is helping them sort of reflect on the last 4 years of medical school and help them sort of get ready for their next phase of professional development, which is a residency. And they have a lot of things to say as they reflect on, you know, who they were when they started the journey, where they are now, and where they're going next.
One through line that I'm hearing you with describing the value of graphic medicine in healthcare is that it offers the reader, whether that's a patient, a doctor, a med student, is the personal insight, or perhaps even a sense of sympathy if you're a healthcare provider, because I imagine the reality is sometimes doctors and other healthcare professionals do need reminding of that personal experience of an illness, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in the medium, because it contains both words and images, it's accessible in a way that text only, or maybe, you know, you're a radio, so just words only, isn't. I mean, because you get to both hear, read, see, you know, the story, and something about the combination of those things helps, I think, people empathize with the story better. I don't want to say one's better than the other, but differently, or certainly in an engaging way. And people engage with comics because they see themselves in the story somehow. Comics are not meant to be exact representations of an experience. They're not like photorealistic images. When you look at a comic, the cartoons are simplified in a certain way. They represent more people. And so something about that feature, I think, helps people empathize with the story. The other thing about comics, I think, that sort of engages readers is that it requires some work on the part of the readers to participate in the co-creation of the story, in a sense, because there's lots of missing data. You have, you know, a panel, and then you have another panel, and another panel, and you leave out some information. Like what happened between panel A and panel B. And then the reader has to sort of figure out, oh yeah, well, what did happen there, and make some inferences. And so they're helping to co-create the story, and they get more involved in it than if everything is sort of spoon-fed to them because they have all the information they could possibly need.
You mentioned that the field of graphic medicine is very expansive. It goes beyond doctors, learning materials, patients, caretakers. Can you tell us about some of the topics that are not as obvious, perhaps to an outside person, that go beyond a hospital or healthcare provider setting?
Yeah, so, I mean, graphic medicine is expanding in the scope of, you know, what counts as graphic medicine. At its heart, it's about stories, I would say, and typically about stories of patients' experience with illness. But there's lots of things that affect people's health and well-being, not just an illness. So there's works on environment, for example, and the impact of, you know, environmental things on people's health and welfare. And global warming has been a topic that's been tackled, and immigration. And, you know, what is the impact of, you know, immigration policies on people's health? And there's been a lot of different works. There's a new book that came out this last year by looking for it for Meredith Lee Vollmer called Graphic Public Health. And she's a public health worker, and she also does cartooning and works with comic artists. And it sort of explores the whole field of public health through comics. One of the chapters of the book is a reprint of a short comic book that she helped write about. It was called No Ordinary Flu, which was a sort of a history of the Spanish flu pandemic in 1918. And it was created with the hope of preparing for the next pandemic. And so this was written before COVID. And when you read this over, it's like eerily prescient. I mean, it's like, wow, we knew what was coming. We saw it coming. We knew what to do to prevent it. We know how to manage this. It's like all these lessons that we could have learned from the Spanish flu. It's all in this comic, you know, that was written, I think it was in 2008. And then, of course, we didn't do those things. And hence we have the global pandemic of COVID-19. So there's a lot of different things, you know, that graphic medicine has done and can continue to do.
If you are about to talk to someone who's never heard of graphic medicine, obviously most people are familiar with comics, but for anyone you come across who has no idea of what this is, what would you say to them as to why we need this, what gap it fills?
Well, I think humans crave stories. We're all, and medical people thrive on storytelling. I mean, that's what we do when we share cases with colleagues, and when patients are telling us what's going on with them, they're telling us stories. And so I think the notion of storytelling is intuitive to people, and graphic medicine is sort of using comics as a medium to tell stories about, you know, about interaction with the healthcare system, whether through illness from the point of view of a patient or from a clinician's point of view, what's it like to be a doctor or a nurse or a medical student, and to sort of tell the stories visually using words and pictures together in sequence. And that's, you know, and so why do we need it? Why do we need anything? I mean, I think it enriches people's experience. It's another way of sharing experiences, but I think it is one way of engaging people through a medium that's accessible. It's fun, it's interesting. The variety of topics as well as styles of telling stories has just grown exponentially, and the creativity that people use to tell stories is just mind-blowing. There's things that you can do with comics that are really difficult to do with other medium, you know, in terms of how you represent time and space and sequencing and the way stories can be told. You can break every rule in comics, which gives a lot of freedom to artists to tell stories in lots of different ways. And that, to me, is really exciting.
Well, Dr. Michael Green, I want to thank you so much for joining me today to explain more about graphic medicine.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Dr. Michael Green is a professor in the Departments of Humanities and Medicine at Penn State College of Medicine. He'll be this year's speaker for the Center for Bioethics and Medical Humanities at the Medical College of Wisconsin Annual Medical Humanities Lecture. That'll be next Tuesday, and you can find more information at wuwm.com. A task force has been developing a plan to address climate change and environmental justice in Milwaukee. The City-County Task Force on Climate and Economic Equity will present its final draft to the Milwaukee Common Council early next year with the goal of it becoming city policy. But first, the task force has been gathering input from the community. Three of the people working on the process include Pam Ritker de la Rosa, Deneen Powell, and Mandy McAllister, who work with Milwaukee's Environmental Collaboration Office. They join WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz. McAllister begins by explaining what their mission is.
We've put together a Climate Justice in Milwaukee presentation. with the goal of really explaining what climate change is, so that when we're talking about making a plan for climate change, you know, people have that background information and we can really start connecting the dots between the issues and concerns that people have in their community right now and what this plan is trying to address. Presented it to Sherman Park. And then since then, we've had intentions of sharing it with other community groups around the city. We haven't presented it yet, but I've spoken to folks at Citizen Action. I've spoken to folks at Voces de la Frontera. And then I just sent it along to 16th Street Health Clinic as well, because I think that is definitely a concern in the community that we're talking about addressing climate change, but the community doesn't have a full understanding of what that is and how it's relating to them.
Danita, I'm going to jump to you. You come to this project after, you know, lots of experience in different facets of environmental justice. So when you look at the goals of the plan and its importance, how should the community be able to interact in this? And what is your goals to help to get there?
Well, I think that the thing that comes to mind right away is that we're not talking enough about climate in our community. And the impacts of climate change and the solutions that are out there, it's happening right now. And we've discussed this before, but there's an opportunity here to break down barriers, to create collective action, to drive people into new jobs, into new sectors, if we do this right. So there's an opportunity here to do a lot with climate change, but we have to start with the conversations in the community. And that means giving the community a voice so that the elected officials perk up, they hear what's being said, they go ahead and say, yeah, let's approve these plans, but not just approve the plan, Susan, but to fund the plans, because that's going to be the most important. The first hoop that we jump through is getting the plan approved. But the ultimate hoop is that funding, so that the work can actually start and we can actually make our city more climate resilient.
It has to be a tough balance of the need of the action, the really great ideas that have been fostered through this task force process. I would think especially those in our communities who are most highly impacted, they stand to lose the most if nothing is done, right? So how does this become a, let's listen to one another and what it is that you need in your neighborhood, in your home? And those are really tough conversations.
Sure, but we're having those conversations now. The month of November, while the climate plan is posted and available for public review, we're actually making our way through the city and talking to different groups about that very thing. What's going on in your neighborhoods? What do you like in your neighborhoods? What would you like to see more of in your neighborhoods? How are you being impacted by climate? How's your neighborhood being impacted by climate? And we see that through, for example, flooding. I mean, that's probably the biggest one here in Milwaukee, flooding and temperatures that continue to go up. I sat through a meeting where I had a group of gardeners who wanted to talk about how their gardens are changing as a result of climate, which was something that you don't necessarily think about. You know, it's just that you could plant something a little too early, or now it might be a little too late. And so the community has an idea of what they want to tackle, what they can solve in their community. And what we want to do is, in addition to that, bring climate solutions or suggestions for solutions to the community. That's what the plan is for. Then the community can look at that plan and say, yeah, you're moving in the right direction, or perhaps maybe you're not moving in the right direction and you guys need to tweak this. And this is what that could look like. So those conversations are happening right now. And I feel like they're really, really quite helpful as we continue to craft the climate and equity plan.
So Pam, before you came onto the ECO team, you worked for a number of years with Clean Wisconsin, and it was in that role that you joined the task force. What have you observed over that time, and how are you feeling at this point about the community involvement, the community voice, and what is hopefully going to become city policy?
I really applaud Mandy and Deneen and the whole education outreach team, which has continued to meet throughout 2022. The other work groups kind of stopped meeting, but education outreach continued because they knew the importance of making sure, how can we best connect with the community around what this plan does? What are we missing? How can we improve it? And we're already seeing that. You know, we had great feedback from a landlord around having tenants and helping them to make their homes more energy efficient. And, you know, I think all that just improves the plan. And again, I'm really proud that we kind of started that from the beginning with the work groups, with energy efficiency experts, with community group members, with members of academia, to just really come up with, you know, best robust ideas. And I really appreciate everyone who joined in on those work groups. We're talking about, you know, 2 hour and a half long meetings every month for all of 2021, basically. And, you know, so starting with that, but then going beyond that and really, you know, I think we are just having really a robust amount of feedback, and using the social pinpoint app as well is really important in terms of getting a sense of where are people who are responding to this plan? Where are they from in the city? Are we getting a good geographic variety of Milwaukeeans who are commenting and providing their feedback on this plan?
I just wanted to just add to what both Deneen and Pam are saying here, just with the how important it is to have the community involved in this. And you'll hear community organizers say this all the time, that communities know the ins and outs of their communities better than anyone. They are the experts. So, and as Pam said, you know, it's like a small group of people isn't going to know everything. So I'm really interested in hearing from the community on, you know, what barriers are they experiencing? We don't know them all. Every community is different. Every family is different. So I'm just thinking about the programs that this plan is trying to implement. Will they be able to access it? And I think that is a really important piece with this being an equity plan. We're trying to address these inequities that have existed for so long. So we need to hear what barriers people are running into to really be able to do that.
You were all at the public forum, and one of the strong messages was, yes, we must make sure that everybody has a piece of this pie, but also that neighborhoods remain their neighborhoods as they improve and become places you want to be, that they're places they can stay and they're not pushed out of that space.
Absolutely. You hear that all the time. As a matter of fact, I just had a climate, community climate conversation at Walnut Way, and that was probably one of the number one concerns that the neighbors discussed was gentrification. That these projects come in, they beautify the neighborhood, then others start to come in, they're being pushed out because they can't afford taxes. So it's important that we also develop plans that protect the people that make the neighborhoods what they are, and make them, you know, Lindsay Heights is an amazing, very connected neighborhood community in our city. And we need to learn how the projects can support and grow the people of that community. And, you know, it starts by also providing living wage jobs, which that's one of the very exciting things about the climate inequity plan, is that the focus is on workforce development, so that we can have these amazing communities that people can actually afford to live in and can afford the taxes, but then also to protect those who are already there, to protect that legacy, and to ensure that if you're a long-term resident of a neighborhood, you're not in any danger of losing your home. We can do some things around that to protect legacy.
I just wanted to mention one other thing too, kind of what Deneen was just saying about, you know, community involvement. This plan can support the community if we get the community involved right now and listen to the community. And I think if we're really intentional about the implementation, we can protect the neighbors that are currently there and their like living situations and yes, the organizations and businesses that they love, because they've been included in the implementation. They are getting funding to implement. You know, they are secure in the work that they are doing. So I think we can address it with that as well.
Mandy McAllister is a member of the Climate and Equity Action Task Force Work Group. Deneen Powell is a fellow with Milwaukee's Environmental Collaboration Office. Pam Ricker de la Rosa is the office's Environmental Sustainability Program Manager. They all spoke with WUWM's Susan Bentz. The public can comment on the proposed Climate and Equity Action Plan through November. It's slated to be considered by the Milwaukee Common Council in February. Did you know that you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Well, just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. Coming up, if you're headed to the Green Bay area for a Packers game or are thinking of planning a weekend trip before the holidays, we've got some recommendations on where to go and what to see in our Wandering Wisconsin segment. But first, we'll meet the founder and director of the Latino Arts String Program at the United Community Center. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Denora Marquez is the founder and director of the Latino Arts String Program at the United Community Center. She's been named one of Milwaukee Magazine's Betty Award recipients, which honors extraordinary women doing great work here in Milwaukee. When Marquez was a child, she immigrated to the U.S., and with the language barrier, bullying, and changes at home, she felt like she didn't have a voice, until a music teacher introduced her to the violin. The instrument became Marquez's voice. It became a connector between her inner self and the outside world. Now, Marquez is supporting the next generation of string musicians by building a relationship with their own voices and culture through music. Marquez joins Lake Effect's Mallory Chang to share more about her work.
I just want to bring it back to the very beginning of when you first started to pick up your violin. What pushed you to first pick up and learn to play the violin?
I was an immigrant child. I arrived in the United States when I was 10 years old. And I did not speak English, and I arrived in Texas at a time when you could be expelled from school if you were speaking Spanish, right? So it was a very quiet first year for me. But then I was handed the instrument, and the instrument literally became my voice, which is really kind of nice because now when I hear my students and my graduates talk about their experience as musicians, as young musicians in the program, they bring back that idea that, you know, that experience is giving them a voice. And so for them, metaphorically, for me, literally, because I couldn't speak, so I had to play. So yeah, that was a beautiful experience. It was a huge blessing. You know, I arrived somewhere where there was an amazing violin teacher, Mr. James Angerstein, who's still alive today. And I try to recognize him as much as I can because, you know, he became a father figure. He became a lifeline. He became, you know, a spiritual guide through music. You know, it's just everything that a good music teacher can do and does do. And then the space where music happened was always the safe space. A school, it was hard because there was a lot of racism and a lot of bullying. And at home, it was difficult because, you know, I had a very dysfunctional family with a lot of domestic violence. But the beauty of it is that whenever I was doing music in either space, I was safe. That's where I got my little expression, violence, no violence. That's kind of how I come to the world of music.
And I want to say that's so beautiful, too, because as a role model now, as a music educator through the Latino Arts Program and now music violin teacher to students here in Milwaukee. But how did you end here to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, of all places?
Well, it was a really roundabout way, to be honest. So I grew up on the border for Ciudad Juarez and then Texas. But then I came up to Chicago and I went to school at Northwestern University and was able to be in Chicago for several years doing other wonderful things unrelated to music. Then I decided to go back to Mexico, back and forth to Mexico from here, and began playing more professionally there. And also began to work with a wonderful friend in the small village where my ancestors are from. In the process of rescuing a tradition, a violin tradition that goes hand in hand with a very old dance tradition, I would say pre-Hispanic dance tradition, even though the violin comes to it after colonization. And together we began the process of rescuing the sones and starting to train young people to play the violin. And I'm happy to say that that project continues on and is really strong and is really beautiful. And one of the legacies from that project is that I was the first woman who went out and played these sones with the dancers on the streets. And that was seen as really odd. And, you know, the men didn't really like that. But now the majority of the young people who are doing this, who are carrying this on, are actually young girls. And it's really amazing to me. I get goosebumps when I think about that. So anyway, in the process of being back there, I met a wonderful cellist, Mr. Wolfgang Laufer, who was there to give workshops, chamber music workshops. And I had a quartet, a classical quartet, and we worked with him a couple of years in a row. And after the second year, I mentioned to him that, you know, my husband wanted to move back to the States, and I was thinking of doing a master's degree, if he could just guide me as to where it might be a good place. And a few months later, he contacted me and offered me a scholarship to come to Milwaukee and do my master's degree here, which was a huge blessing. Like I said, I mean, it's just a life of blessings is what I've had. while I was doing my master's in chamber music and viola, I had another blessing in a strange form. I actually hurt my hand, which made me begin to explore other avenues into teaching. So I got a master's in string pedagogy. And when I finished that, my husband was doing an exhibit at the United Community Center. He invited me, of course, to see the exhibit and to the gala. And I just fell in love with the place. The United Community Center is this amazing place. It has very deep roots in our community, has been serving our community for 53 years. And so I went and I thought, well, this is it. This is the place. This is where I get to give back. You know, this is where I get to thank my teachers, you know, for what I had, what would save my life, the saving grace, right? So I proposed the project, and it was something very new to the agency. It wasn't something they had ever considered, or, you know, wasn't really in their spectrum. And also because I wasn't coming in to propose like a regular school orchestra program. I was coming in to propose a program that would require a lot of resources, but that would also give our students an upper hand in the possibility of exploring music seriously and acquiring all of the skills and personal development that implies. And so they were willing to give it a shot. And that was very exciting to me. And I just invited people to apply. And that very night, I had over 100 applications. And the rest is history. I mean, from there on, every year, we've had at least 100, 150 people apply to the program every year.
And I think something that's really important that I think is so meaningful, you started the Latino Art Strings program at the United Community Center to pass on what you call a knowledge of heritage education of traditional Latin American music, along with, you know, classical technique. And like what you said, over 100 to 200 students apply or enroll each year. And what types of responses do you get from students learning more about music, about potentially their own traditions and heritage through music? And what does that mean to you as an educator now?
It is a really important part because, as you know, as immigrants or children of immigrants, our cultures are either misunderstood or poorly portrayed or absolutely not talked about, you know, not truly talked about. And so to me, a good way to do that was through music, you know, for our students and for our families to feel represented immediately through what their children were learning to play, right? So even though our students, you know, will develop classical techniques, will play Mozart and Bach and Tchaikovsky and, you know, Saint-Saëns and all the various European composers, which we all love, but they will start from day one, you know, playing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star and La Bamba. But also to know that they are keeping up a tradition and taking it all over the region and all over the country and being celebrated for it. And for them to be able to have the pride
Not only did they do this through a very difficult activity, which is playing an instrument like that, but they did it by representing themselves culturally. You know, going through the whole process myself of understanding what having been an immigrant has meant, what things one leaves behind in that process, what things one tries to recuperate in the process to see that this project is giving those young people an upper hand in that process, that they don't feel like they've lost everything, that they know they can be filled with pride for who they are, that that creates who the voice that they will then project into their lives, into the future lives, regardless of what they're doing. We have a young man who is undocumented, and he got a full ride to Harvard, right? Which is really amazing in itself. But you know what really blows me away? He is directing the Harvard Mariachi right now, right? So it's like, to him, getting to Harvard was amazing, but to be able to continue to share who he is and what his roots are is, you know, the most important to him right now. And that's sort of to answer your question. It's I think it's so beautiful. Our graduates are either coming back to teach for us, and or they're creating their own ensembles and you know, carrying on the tradition through their music, or they're doing it in the privacy of their own home and just enjoying it themselves. But it carries through with the pride of who they are. And I have to say that I'm really happy and humble that this whole process is being recognized. But this is not all my doing. I mean, obviously, here I am at the United Community Center. If it wasn't an agency that believed in what we're doing and raised the money to make it happen, this would not happen. And when I started the project, I started with 23 students, just me as the teacher. But now I run a full program of 200 plus students and, you know, 100 plus applicants every year, and, you know, 10 instructors and, you know, coaches and, you know, graduates from the program working in there. So we have a beautiful full program now, thanks to all the support that we're getting.
Denora Marquez is the founder and director of the Latino Arts String Program at the United Community Center. She was named one of Milwaukee Magazine's 2022 Betty Awards recipients, and Marquez spoke with Like Effect's Mallory Chang. You can learn more about Marquez in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. November is Native American Heritage Month, and if you were thinking about taking a weekend trip, we'll tell you how you can incorporate Native American tourism into planning that trip. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Wisconsin is home to 50 state parks, more than 40 historic landmarks, and of course, lots of good beer and cheese. With so many unexpected adventures and places to discover, why not plan your next vacation right here in our home state? We've teamed up with Travel Wisconsin to help you make it happen. Wandering Wisconsin is our new monthly conversation where we bring you suggestions for great places to visit throughout the state. This month, we're focusing on Native American tourism for Native American Heritage Month. Suzette Brewer is the Executive Director of Native American Tourism of Wisconsin, and Amanda Weibel is the Communications Officer for Travel Wisconsin. They join Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen.
Suzette, Wisconsin has 11 federally recognized tribes throughout the state, and I'm sure each has a unique reason to visit, but could you start with sharing what people might find when they visit the tribal communities of Wisconsin?
Oh, there is so much out there for people to explore. I'm so happy you asked that question. I think the main thing that people need to know is that, you know, the tribal communities are, many of them are far north in the North Woods. And so they have a beautiful, like starting with Red Cliff, they just have you know, the ice caves, and they have ice fishing, and there's, you know, it's a very peaceful environment on the reservations. And so what they could expect to see, honestly, is a lot of nature, a lot of outdoor activities, a lot of things to do outside, bird watching, that kind of thing. I think there's just so much uniqueness to these communities. They still have, you know, a lot of their cultural museums and archives and so forth that will still be open during the winter. So there's so many things that people can still do in the winter in our tribal communities. And so I just want to encourage everybody to continue discovering Native Wisconsin.
Yeah, you're mentioning the weather is starting to change. Temperatures are dropping. Snow will be covering parts of the state before we know it, if it hasn't already. So what are some winter activities people might be able to take part in?
We have, and this is just the short list, we have snowmobiling, cross-country skiing, snowshoeing. We've got ice fishing. We've got bird watching, as I mentioned before. We've got, there's a tribal game, if you will. It's a winter game called Snow Snake. And I sort of call it a native version of curling, where groups of people get together. They construct a race course out in the snow, sort of a groove in the snow that they create. And then they literally launch poles or sticks in these grooves. And it sounds really, I would say, archaic in some ways, but to me, that's the beauty of it, is that it's an ancient tribal tradition that stretches back thousands of years that people still play to this day. It's a really fun form of competition and community gathering and togetherness that I think people really enjoy in the winter months in the tribal communities. There's all kinds of stuff that goes on in the Native communities in the winter. And so I just want to encourage everybody to get out there and get outside and enjoy the weather, enjoy the winter activities that we have to offer. As I said before, our museums are generally open during the winter months, and so people can still go and enjoy artwork and cultural patrimony of the tribes that they may not get to see in other parts of the country. And I think those are the things that are really unique about our communities, is that our tribal museums really are sort of a wealth of tribal knowledge, and the people who work there are very passionate about what they do for a living. I think one of the important things too to get people to think about is that you don't have to go to Iceland to see the Northern Lights. I know that's like the big thing in the United States, is to go to Iceland to see the Northern Lights. You can go to Northern Wisconsin. We are working with the Dark Skies Initiative, and that's one of the things that I feel is really important for people to understand, is that, you know, you can, if you know a solar flare is coming, you can book a room at one of the tribal hotels. We live in some of the darkest spots in Wisconsin, but they all have hotels. And so if there is a solar flare coming or any kind of a Northern Lights opportunity, I just think it's a once in a lifetime unique experience for people who may live in the urban areas, that they may want to go and book a room and enjoy the Northern Lights from the comfort of their own state. That's another option for people this winter, is to think about the Northern Lights. So I just, you know, want to encourage people to think about, you know, adding the tribes to their itineraries when they're traveling around the state in the winter.
All right, Amanda, I'm going to turn to you to help folks plan a trip for Native American Heritage Month, and we're going to focus in on the Oneida Nation near the Green Bay area and a few things people can do around there. So Suzette was just mentioning some museums. There's an Oneida Nation Museum in De Pere. What will people learn and see there?
The Oneida Museum is a great stop to learn more about Oneida customs, heritage, and history. They really have a wide range of exhibits, including things like the Oneida creation story, the history of the Oneida lace makers. They have an interactive longhouse, and much, much more. They have self-guided tours or guided tours. And like Suzette said, I definitely suggest taking a guided tour. That's when you're going to be able to learn from the experts and really get a wealth of information from that cultural education staff. The tour takes about an hour, but before you leave, make sure that you also take some time to check out the museum gift shop. You're going to find some really beautiful arts and crafts, jewelry, and other goods, and you'll want to take something home with you to remember your trip.
Also in that area is the Ukwakwa Farm. What can you tell me about that?
So many people are looking for hands-on experiences when they travel, and Ukwakwa does this so well. It's owned by Becky and Steve Webster, who are Oneida Nation citizens, and they really built this farm from the ground up with the help of friends and family. So they practice traditional indigenous farming techniques, from planting and cultivating to seed keeping, food preparation, and storage. And they're learning these techniques along the way themselves, which is why they're dedicated to helping share that knowledge with others. So I had the pleasure of visiting the farm this fall and participating in a corn mush class. We used traditional tools to pound whole kernels of corn, and then we sifted out the fine ground corn and put the large kernels back in the bowl to pound some more. And it took some time, it took some patience, and it took some muscle, but it was such a fun experience. And while we worked, Becky told us about how she had made the basket that we used to sift the corn kernels, and how a neighbor had made some of the other tools that we were using. So every single part of the process is intentional, and it's connected to their community. And that just makes the end result all the more meaningful. So once we had ground enough corn, Becky and Steve cooked it for us over an open fire with some water and maple syrup, and it was absolutely delicious. That's just one of the classes that they have available at Ukwakwa. For anyone who wants to learn more about Native American food practices, definitely recommend checking out their website to see what's available each season.
And if people don't fill up at the farm, or if they've spent the day at the museum and they're looking for somewhere to eat, where could they go to support Native American tourism?
Cedar and Sage Grill House is a great place to check out. They really focus on local indigenous foods. So they're sourcing from places like the Oneida Nation Farm, the Oneida Orchard, and the Oneida Cannery. And when I learned more about this restaurant, it really reminded me actually of something that Becky Webster said during my tour of Ukwakwa. She was talking about their process for preserving food to use throughout the year. And she said, "If you're hungry, you should have thought about that 9 months ago." And it's really clear that Cedar and Sage Grill House, they're sourcing ingredients from local farmers and producers who share the same mentality. They're thinking about what's in season, but they're also thinking about how they can preserve those things and make it part of their menu throughout the year. So one dish you should definitely keep an eye out for is the Three Sisters vegetables. So it's corn, beans, and squash, and they're grown together in a way that each plant supports one another. And it's just a really unique piece of that Native American heritage, and you'll see it in a lot of different spots on the menu.
One thing that I want to add about Cedar and Sage, to just sort of add to Amanda's comments, they also have really fantastic smoked corn polenta that they use with the corn that they buy from the tribe. But I also want to mention that they have buying agreements with other tribes in Wisconsin. So, you know, that just increases their sustainability. I know that they work with the Red Cliff tribe to get their fish. And they also buy other produce from some of the other tribes like Forest County. So the tribes really are working together as a part of their food sovereignty and as a part of their return to indigenous type foods to really sort of bring that back into the communities and also have that inform how they do business in their hotels and their restaurants.
Tourism is the leading industry for tribal economies and plays a significant role in generating revenue. So Suzette, can you talk about why it's important for people to factor Native American tourism into their trip planning?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you asked that, mainly because tourism is the biggest industry in Indian Country, hands down. I know that nationwide, it creates something like $40 billion in business every year. And that is both the primary and ancillary businesses that are related to gaming. That includes golf courses, hotels, again, restaurants, and other businesses that are attached to the industry by the tribes. And so I think it's one of the things where these are small communities, these are all home-based jobs, these are not jobs that can be outsourced to other countries in terms of, you know, what they do. I mean, these are all American jobs right here in the United States that are going to stay in the United States. And so this is what builds their economies. Tourism is basically the economy that supports, you know, tribal business in so many different ways, and it creates income and revenues for important services, health and human services in terms of healthcare, housing, education, and all those types of things that that really those revenues are a critical piece in building tribal economies. So tourism is in fact, a crucial piece of the economic development for the tribes, not just in the state of Wisconsin, but across the country. And so I think it's important for people when they're thinking about their travel plans to, you know, maybe think about dropping in one of the tribal communities over the winter, in the summer, in the spring, and checking out the tribe's communities and discovering Native Wisconsin.
Well, Suzette and Amanda, thank you so much for joining me here on Lake Effect for Wandering Wisconsin.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Suzette Brewer is the Executive Director of Native American Tourism of Wisconsin, and Amanda Weibel is the Communications Officer for Travel Wisconsin. They both spoke with Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen, and you can hear last month's Wandering Wisconsin at WUWM.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Mallory Chang and Joy Powers join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Kate Flynn and Chase Browning. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Chuck Kornbach, Lena Tran, and Susan Bentz from the WUWM News team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. Lake Effect is taking a break next week for the Thanksgiving holiday, so you won't hear our show at noon like normal. But don't worry, we'll be back with new interviews and conversations the following week on November 28th. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.